Welcome back to the Commerce Collective podcast brought to you by Flywheel. You're listening to This Month Above the Fold, a monthly series on the Commerce Collective feed where Patrick Miller, co-founder of Flywheel, covers the most important e-commerce stories each month, and this is your March 2024 recap. I'm Emma Irwin, senior editor and specialist at Flywheel. Let's get into it.
I'm going to start us off to, oh, I forgot to say, hi, Patrick.
Hey, good morning.
Because they yell at me. My question for you today is, I'm curious if you, because we're not talking about Temu in the actual recording, I'm curious if you've purchased anything cool off of Temu recently.
No, because my son's preschool teachers are now mocking me when I drop him off because he will only wear the dinosaur t-shirts that I bought for him on Temu. So I've decided to try to take a little bit of a hiatus on my addiction of buying toddler dinosaur t-shirts on Temu for a bit. But I will, you know, although I was trying to find an $800, an $801 item to see if it would not then deal, like, would I then be charged the tariff of 19.3%? There's nothing that's $800 on Temu. I was going to, you know, use the corporate card. So yeah. So anyway, I'm taking a pause from my addiction for a little bit.
Good. Okay. I was curious yesterday because I'm mad at my sofa at the moment. And I was like, I wonder if Temu sells like a sofa.
No way.
And there's a couple on there, but they
really?
All have, yes. And I want to say that they were like less than $100, which means you probably shouldn't buy.
Roll the dice. What could go wrong?
Yeah. I thought about it though. I was like, hey, this could be like an experiment because it's less than $100.
Do it. Put it on the card.
Yeah.
Put on the corporate card. It's a podcast right there.
Yeah, there you go. We'll circle back on that one next month. Okay. So today we are covering MFA or made for advertising / junk inventory / what we're doing about it. We're also going to cover Google's dive into retail media and then retail media from the Wall Street perspective. So story number one, MFA, junk inventory, what we're doing about it. Flywheel recently published a really awesome blog about all of this with the help of our data science team, which everyone listening should go and read as well. But I want to start off here with we've talked about MFA on this podcast before, but it's gaining traction. It's something that now I can't stop seeing, which is probably for the better. But I'm kind of curious, what is your current POV? Like, where do we start with MFA? And then we'll get into ourselves for it. But what's up?
I think the biggie is, you know, anytime any of us have ever searched for a recipe, we've experienced, you know, MFAs. And you go to a recipe site and it's just like you just get bombarded with ads and you can't figure out what the right temperature for chicken to be done is, which is incredibly just frustrating. And for brands, you know, as people shifted to DSPs and the ability to buy, you know, horizontally at scale across thousands of sites, if I'm not a D2C, so I'm a consumer brand that's traditionally selling through retailers, the only metrics I had to say, is it good or is it bad, is did the customer click on the item? Did the customer see the ad? And the problem with both of those is, well, yeah, when I go to a recipe site, I see the ads and I see them all over the place. Yeah, they load, but I ain't paying any attention to them. So, you know, what's the efficacy actually? And then on a click, yeah, I accidentally click ads all the time. And so, you know, I'm holding a toddler and I'm looking for something and I'm all of a sudden clicking on an ad. Both are false positives. And currently, brands don't want to pay any more for a 300 by 250 than, you know, anybody else does. But so they chase low CPMs. And so these MFA sites can offer low CPMs and the appearance of performance via clicks or views. And so the only way to measure, you know, is sort of then saying, okay, well, let's use MMMs and regression. But that's looking at aggregate across all the impressions, all the spend, and it's not typically going down to a site level. So brands have been a bit blind to this and because they haven't had a closed loop. And so what's changed is as, you know, so we have more and more closed loop information, you know, when working with retailers, we can start to see, okay, well, let's look at this in aggregate and let's leverage clean rooms to say, well, what is the performance, you know, on a site level? And can we aggregate? Can we isolate? And then we've then said, also looking at it, hey, it's different by brand. And so some sites, because MFA is not binary, it's a gradient. And what is the right, you know, ad load? And so we then sort of created an algorithm that does it on a, you know, on a brand level, looks at the performance by site and then ranks them and then just, you know, just cuts off the stuff, you know, at the tail. And what we've seen is performance goes up and guess what? CPMs go up. Why? because they're good publishers and, you know, and sort of helps brands find performance and trade on value, not just on cost.
Got it. Got it. I like how casual you were with. We just developed an algorithm that like is the total solve for this.
Well, it was royal we. It wasn't me, you know, but I'm there for emotional support. But no, a phenomenal team digging into this and figuring this out. And it's really enjoyable to watch them work.
Yeah, they're awesome. I'm curious, do you foresee somewhere down the line, like publishing landscape where MFA just like doesn't exist anymore?
Oh, yeah. I think it's going to get starved. Because it's in their economic best interest to do this right now because of the ignorance of the purchaser, because they didn't have a closed loop. Well, as you shine a light on that and you figure it out, the brands will then shift away from these sites. There will no longer be the economic interest in creating this, and this will move on. And oh, by the way, the other thing that, you know, that is even more of a wrecking ball are generative AI. And so, like, if I now, like, when I go to Google and I search for, you know, chicken recipe or what temperature should chicken be, the LLM is just telling me. And so now I'm not even going to the site. And why is Google willing to do that? Well, they don't make a whole lot of money on a CPC for a chicken recipe. So you have to then look at every query and where does an LLM go? Where does an LLM not go? Where is it helpful? Where is it not? And where is it in Google's best interest to show an LLM versus not? And so, if you search for like a high yield query, local lawyer would be one. I bet you they're not going to do an LLM anytime soon there because of just the amount of money they would then lose. And can the LLM do a good job? Recipe site, what are they losing? Well, they're not losing anything on a CPC basis. The only thing they would then be losing would then be the yield via their DSP based off of the sites that are then serving on those. But they have to be willing to risk that because it's just an awful customer experience, you know, as it currently is. And it's pennies.
Yeah, I gotcha. Let's do story number two, which is that Google has added offsite retail media capabilities to Search Ads 360 via a closed beta at the moment. Tell me about the magnitude of this, or maybe there isn't a magnitude. I'm not entirely
big deal.
Sure.
Real but big
tell
deal.
Me about, okay, good clarification.
Yeah. So right now, brands buying through Google, you know, have historically, and again, we're talking consumer brands, not talking D2Cs, consumer brands who sell through retailers, you know, have historically purchased traffic and mostly sent it back to brand.com, where they typically don't sell a whole lot of widgets. And so increasingly, Google's saying, you know, hey, retailer, let's team up and, you know, we can then unlock brand dollars to send not to brand.com, to send to retailer. And so starting with Lowe's, they can then start to send that traffic and then hand back to the brand, you know, what does the attribution look like and what do the sales look like? And so I think this is a huge unlock. A company that we work with, Symbiosis, does something similar, but Google doing it themselves is a big deal. And so the question will be sort of like, well, how much data do they end up exposing? What does that look like? What does the performance look like? And then a really interesting question starts becoming around fair and equitable. And so if I'm then said brand, how do I determine which retailer gets traffic from where? How do I make sure that is fair and equitable? How do I make sure that is not providing price support and then divvying up where is it my trade spend? Where is it my brand spend? So lots of interesting questions after that, but it's absolutely a big deal just because of the amount of traffic that goes through Google in all its different iterations.
Gotcha. I see the magnitude. I can see it out the
window. Well, and even a simple one, like PLAs, brands can't buy right now. So if you go to a PLA, if you look at a PLA, they all go back to either a D2C or to a retail site. It's great inventory. And so if a brand can now, you know, I have not seen it yet, you know, in the wild, but if a brand can now buy a PLA, that's a huge unlock.
Gotcha. I'm curious, in the broader like competitive landscape of retail media networks and retail media in general, how does this play? How does this come into the landscape and like impact other retail media networks?
So I look at it as sort of the, you know, it's sort of an and statement of retailer, and this actually feeds in well to the next topic of when do the retailers partner? When do the retailers build? What are the sort of economics of both of those? And then how do the brands then interface? And so, sort of, are you growing share? You know, are you sort of dividing share? And then how do I then, you know, decide if I'm a brand, what bucket of funding is going to which opportunity? And then how do I then measure success? So I think this creates a bit of complexity in the short term, but ultimately less complexity in the long term. And it bridges between, hey, what's a brand spend? And then what's a performance spend? And then sort of to me, the question is like, okay, well, when is it brand building? When is it performance? And much of that might be a question of time and creative. And so if it is a depth of the impression is deep and the time horizon for which I'm building the brand is long, okay, it's brand building. If it is a shallower impression, you know, spa, you know, a Google link, et cetera, and the time to conversion is short, okay, now it is performance. And so we can then start to create sort of different ways of allocating dollars based off of those time horizons and the depth of impression to then say, hey, this is performance, this is brand, as opposed to just going in on the banner basis. And what I mean by banner basis is, you know, 4 years ago, I don't know, whoever, CBS or whatever, was doing Thursday Night Football. Okay, it's clearly a brand spend. Well, now Amazon's doing Thursday Night Football. Is that now a trade spend? I don't think so. And this is where it's sort of regulatory environment comes into play and sort of, you know, how do regulators look at that? And is it price support? We'll see, you know, as the politics shake out.
I see. That does tie in very nicely to the next story. So I like the order that I chose of these stories. But for context for the audience, AdExchanger published this piece kind of looking at retail media from the Wall Street / capital expenditure lens. They kind of state that for CFOs and investors, the explosion of retail media is one part of a much larger, more perilous transition from focusing on operating expenses to focusing more on capital expenditures. So I was going to ask you, like, why this piqued your interest, just because the interview itself in the article is not that in-depth and detailed, but I think it's an interesting topic. So I'd love to, if there's anything else you wanted to add on there. And then I'm also really interested in, he uses the word perilous to describe this transition, and I'm wondering if you agree with the use of the word perilous.
If I look at, you know, most retailer profit, it is I buy the widget for X, I sell the widget for Y, and the delta, you know, taking out my expenses is my profit, right? So it's very much a day-to-day operating expense. And that's why sort of the, you know, retailers, if you look at their how much GMV goes through them as a function of versus their margin, retail is famously, especially grocery, very, very low margin business. Okay, now if I contrast that with advertising, you're selling air. So it doesn't cost a whole lot once you build the thing. And so you got to then sort of deploy the capital to then build the thing, to then sell the air, to then have the high gross margins. You know, famously, you look at Google's margins, look at Meta's margins, et cetera. It's a whole lot higher. And so if I'm a retailer and in, you know, when, you know, Doug McMillon, you know, said this in an earnings call a couple of years ago, he's like, I've never seen gross margins like this. You know, so he's in love. It's great. And everybody looks at Amazon's advertising business and they're like, oh my God, the free cash flow, you know, moving through that thing. It's unreal. It doesn't look like, you know, selling, you know, toilet paper online. And so, you know, where it's, you know, very low margin. So all the retailers are saying, hey, I would love to have a high gross margin business. Let's go spin up an advertising business. And okay, but then there's a big question that then comes, which is, okay, am I building this thing? Am I buying tech or am I partnering? And those are really different. And I think the article fails to distinguish there. And so, you know, sort of the high gross margin comes post high capital expenditure to build the thing. And so if I look at Amazon's business, they build the thing. If I look at much of Walmart's business on the search side, they build the thing, or Target side on the display side, they're building the thing. But then lots of other retailers are then partnering because they're not big enough to build a thing because they have to deploy so much money. So if I'm putting on my investor hat and I'm looking at, you know, sort of what is the upside of these things, it's like, okay, long term, who is building what? If they do build it and they have enough scale, they're going to unlock a high gross margin business. If they are partnering, okay, you know, there might be higher gross margins than, you know, traditional retail, but it's not, you know, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow that is if you build it. And so I think the article overly simplified in saying that it's, hey, if they just do advertising, it's CapEx. It's like, yeah, maybe if they're building. And I think that then falls into sort of the investors of like, all right, well, are these margins, you know, what does this look like long term? And oh, by the way, where's the money coming from? So is this all incremental dollars that are coming into the retailer? And they are, you know, so that thus, even if it's not, you know, even if it's partnering and it's not the high gross margins, well, still it's higher gross margins than traditional retail. But if it's dollars that are coming from existing in-store, i.e., let's say an NCAP then moves over to somebody's DSP that they're partnering with, well, then NCAP's basically 100% gross margin, and then it's shifting over to a DSP where the margin's much more compressed. So if I'm an investor, why am I going to then, you know, sort of increase my valuation of that retailer based on a construct that might not be as advantageous? So, you know, we'll see how it shakes out, but I think it's good that people are starting to talk about it and understand what's actually powering these various networks and what does that look like.
They should have interviewed you. It would have been a little bit more thorough, but gotcha. Yeah, it caught my attention because I was like, oh, I haven't seen this narrative kind of discussed. So
yeah, if you talk to Wall Street analysts, the analysts are thinking about this. It's just starting to get into sort of mass press, but it's an important one. It's a really important one.
Got it. But it's probably for the better that I don't talk to Wall Street analysts as part of my job. But okay. My last question for you is, what is your favorite story out of these three?
I mean, just as a customer, as a user, I absolutely hate them. And so anything that we can do to starve them and make it easier for me to find a chicken recipe, I'm pretty happy about.
I feel you. I was like, let me make chocolate chip cookies. I just want to bake something. And I hadn't baked in years. And I went to one recipe and I was like, oh my God.
It's awful. You can't even find it. But it's also why different publishers, it's like the New York Times cooking, where it's like, yep, you know what? It's worth paying because they have a great, repository of recipes. I don't know. Or buy a cookbook, heaven forbid.
Yeah. Crazy.
And that's it for this month's e-commerce news. Tune into next month's episode for the latest and greatest what truly belongs above the fold in e-com news. I'm Emma Irwin, and I'll see you next time.